This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
This year, Ukraine erupted in protests that saw a million people gather in the Maidan, Kiev's independence square, to voice their opposition to the government of the day. The protesters were subjected to police violence, which left 98 people dead, approximately 15,000 injured, and 100 considered missing. The movement forced the president and top officials to concede that they could not govern and led to an election in May. Petro Poroshenko ran on a pro-European Union platform and won with over 50% of the vote. Marusia Bersirkiv is a Canadian filmmaker of Ukrainian descent. She organized a Kiev film crew and began directing a documentary about activists in Ukraine during and after the Euromaidan Revolution. The crew filmed the meeting of feminist organizers in Kharkiv. In Kiev, they did interviews at a safe house for LGBT refugees from Donetsk. Marusia Bersirkiv joins me this morning from Toronto. Marusia is an associate professor of media theory at Ryerson University there, where she is co-director of the Studio for Media Activism and Critical Thought. Hello, Marusia.
Hi, Jane.
So what was your goal in bringing together a crew in Kiev to make a film at this politically volatile time?
I was very aware that there is an information war going on, fueled by Russian propaganda, and that Ukraine is losing the information war because they don't have the resources to conduct an information initiative across all, you know, media platforms. So in a sense, it was going back to my activist roots, wanting to do my bit to help educate and help inspire people to have a sense of solidarity about what's going on in Ukraine, and particularly to do it from a queer and feminist perspective.
Now, your film is called The Women Stayed. Why did you choose that title?
Well, actually, the title's kind of in flux right now. I went to Ukraine initially as part of my sabbatical research to examine uses of social media and protests. And it was 2 months after the Euromaidan revolution had ended, and it was a good time to do that, it seemed. But what people wanted to talk about was what had happened on the Maidan, not just social media use, but their really embodied protest. So the first thing I heard about was the presence of women and feminists on the Maidan. Many, many different groups organized. It was an unprecedented moment of cultural diversity in Ukraine. But I learned about a group that called itself the Zhinocha Sotnya, the Women's Battalion, ironically naming themselves in a militarist manner, but really doing non-militarist things like organizing discussions, feminist film screenings. This is in the middle of a revolution, and self-defense classes. And there were those who were fighting on the front lines, but really on every front, in every possible way, trying to be part of this people's revolution and build the visibility of women in Ukraine.
Now, I understand that the Maidan has been described as a kind of Occupy movement writ large. Would you think that would be a good description?
Yeah, that was what really struck me. When I came to Ukraine at the end of April of this year, and I thought the revolution was over. I was kind of sorry to have missed it in a way. But the square was still full of tents and, you know, hundreds of people from all over Ukraine who said they were going to stay at least until a peaceful election, which happened in May. The Maidan as such, as an occupation of the main square, was disassembled, I think, sometime in July. But while I was there, what I saw was that not only were there, you know, lots of men in army fatigues kind of symbolically defending the square and thus Ukraine, but also just every day I'd walk through the square after doing my research work around 5 p.m. and there would be like 10 soup kitchens operating, feeding not just the people on the square, but anyone who wanted to come, you know, people with very little money or just people who had been on the Maidan and wanted to carry on the conversation. So like Occupy, it was about changing the discourse, changing the conversation about how government should operate, but also how people should govern themselves. So it was the beginning of a resurgence of very, very active civil society building in Ukraine.
Did you find that your assessment of the Euromaidan movement was different when you got there than what you thought about it before you went?
Absolutely. It was very enlightening. I immediately saw how standard media in the West and to a large extent left media in the West had gotten things wrong. For example, you know, a big issue in the Western discourse has been the presence of the far right in Ukraine. And I realized that was, and I've for a long time been outspoken about the history of anti-Semitism in Ukrainian history and the need to acknowledge it and do memory work around it. But what I saw was that the right sector was a minority, and instead it was very much a coalition, you know, and many, many people who didn't define themselves in any political way, but simply wanted to, had enough of corruption and enough of Russian domination and wanted to change things. So that was one thing. The other was the involvement of women. I hadn't read anything in the Western press about the feminist movement in Ukraine. I knew almost nothing about the extent of LGBT organizing in Ukraine. There's over 40 LGBT organizations active right now in the country. So many of my ideas about the country of my ancestors changed, and I grew to understand that many of our ideas about Ukraine and Eastern Europe in the West are kind of Orientalist, and even myself as a diasporic Ukrainian had absorbed some of those ideas of a superior notion of the West and a kind of othering notion of the East.
Now, you say that we don't hear much about LGBT participants in the Euromaidan movement, and you say you hadn't heard, and of course, for us in the West who are maybe even less involved, we haven't heard either. What is their political agenda?
Well, every group is very different. Some groups are operating on fumes, on nothing, on no funding. Others are funded by NGOs. There's a major gay organization in Kyiv that's funded by the Elton John Foundation. There's initiatives that are funded by the Green Party. And they're all working on different issues, whether it's health issues for around AIDS and gay men. There's a group in another outside of Kyiv, another region of Ukraine that works on health issues for lesbians. I met someone who is his organization does academic research on how LGBT people are represented in the media. The organization that I got to know the most is Insight in Kyiv, because one of the things they're doing is organizing around LGBT refugees from the Russian occupied areas of eastern Ukraine, and so our film crew went to this shelter organized by Insight and interviewed LGBT people there. So really a very wide agenda, almost no focus on same-sex marriage as there is here. Some groups are interested in promoting civil unions for economic reasons, for very practical reasons like hospital visitation rights and so on. Really multiple sites of organizing.
Now, you mentioned visiting the shelter for LGBT folks fleeing the war in Donetsk, the project of Insight, as you said. What did you learn from people that you interviewed there?
I could understand it somehow on a very personal level, because the conversations we had were so intimate in a way, sort of devoid of rhetoric, but really people just talking about their experience of their love of, one woman talked about her love of the city of Donetsk and how beautiful it is. And then, almost in the same breath talking about how, because she was a Ukrainian nationalist, she became targeted. And so she and other nationalists became the focus of wanted posters placed around the city. So she was being hunted. Her contact information was publicized. And it wasn't necessarily because she was lesbian, but lesbian and gay identity has been used as a wedge issue by Russia and by the Orthodox Church all over Eastern Europe, with the idea that LGBT people are the sort of the decadent bad news of becoming part of Europe, becoming part of the EU. So LGBT people have been targeted for that reason. So I learned more about that and really understood that for the LGBT community, there was no other choice than to want to become part of the European Union. The choice was very stark. It was either Russia with its anti-gay laws or the European Union with all of its problems and contradictions, but with a broader agenda around issues of sexuality.
Now, Russia denies sending troops or equipment to the rebels in eastern Ukraine and accuses the Ukrainian government of using indiscriminate force against civilians in the two eastern territories of Donetsk and Luhansk. How do you assess what's happening on the ground there?
Well, I haven't been on the ground in Donetsk. It was too dangerous for us to travel there, but I didn't really need to be because I met with refugees who had, who had lost everything. I interviewed people from the Jewish community who have been essentially, banished or targeted or made to flee Donetsk. I talked to people who saw how citizens of Donetsk were paid off to join the separatist movement. I mean, it's very complicated and it's hard to sum up in a short interview because there is also a divide, not so much between language issues, but between those who an older generation that idealizes their memories of being under Soviet rule, and a younger generation that is, internet savvy and can read beyond the lines of Russian propaganda. Crimea, things are very difficult there under Russian occupation. There's absolutely no doubt that. I mean, I don't even know that I can sort of take seriously any kind of assumption that Russians are not, the Russian army is not present in Ukraine. I mean, all kinds of international observing groups and human rights groups have documented what's been going on there.
You started out our conversation this morning by describing yourself and your film crew as fighting the information war in Ukraine. What is the specific nature of that battle to define the narrative in Ukraine?
One of the ways in which Russia is sort of trying to diminish the reputation of Ukraine is by describing it as fascist or Banderite, which is Bandera was a right-wing, now deceased leader in Western Ukraine. As most of us know, there were presidential elections in Ukraine in May, and only 2% of the population voted for the right sex. Compared to, 8-10% of right-wing support in other parts of Europe. So we know that to be an unfortunate myth. I think that Russia has kind of taken up a notion that has come out of the West as well, of Ukraine as a primitive country in need of guidance. But what I saw was an intense civic engagement. Ukraine is one of the most civically involved countries in Europe right now. People have learned to work around government because for decades they haven't been able to trust government because of a long history of corruption that comes out of Russian domination of government there. So the Euromaidan was truly revolutionary, not just in overthrowing a government. I mean, imagine if we were able to overthrow Harper by meeting, on Parliament Hill from all over the country and joining forces, a million of us for 3 months. But it wasn't just that. It was that really changed the nature of ideas of citizenship in Ukraine from a kind of passive post-Soviet notion of, government will take care of everything if inadequately, to a notion that, no, we have to do it ourselves. So the level of organizing, the level of knowledge about local, regional, and national government is extraordinary. And so that's really what I'm trying to focus on in the film work that I'm doing.
When do you think we'll be able to see your film?
Oh, that's a really good question, Jane. starting editing on Monday, so that's exciting. It's turning out that I'm working on, I've realized I've got two films that I'm working on. So the first one will be a film about LGBT issues in Ukraine, but the situation of, as I talked about, queers being oppressed and banished from the East, but also the very vibrant and inspiring level of queer organizing in Ukraine. The second film still kind of formulating itself, but will be a sort of more general look at the building of civil society in Ukraine. Slavoj Žižek wrote an article that I really loved called What Europe Can Learn from Ukraine. And for me, the theme is really what the West can learn from Ukraine in terms of, how to really change our world, our sense of nationhood, and how to be active citizens. So, I can't give you a release date for either of them, but I am hoping for a spring release for the film about LGBT people in Ukraine.
Great. Well, thanks so much for talking to me this morning, Marusia.
Thanks, Jane. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Marusia Bersurkiv. Marusia is an author, filmmaker, and associate professor of media theory at Ryerson University in Toronto, where she is co-director of the Studio for Media Activism and Critical Thought.